Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening, everyone. It's lucky Friday the 13th, December 2013. And I'm so happy to have Nick Brown with me. He is from, one of the places you can find him is at www.antiimperialism.com. And we're going to be talking with him in just a couple minutes. I first have a couple announcements to make that, so many of us take for granted the fact that we have heat and food and clothing. And tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday, on the Consciousness Shift show, well, actually, it's on Here Be Monsters, it's the station on Blog Talk. My friend and sister, Gwen Holdenberry, is going to be talking with people about a frontline holiday. So if you would just go to Here Be Monsters on Blog Talk Radio. Also, on Facebook, there is a page called A Frontline Holiday. Now, this is for actually communities in America that have suffered through climate disaster of whatever kind. Last year, the Gulf Coast got a lot of things from the organization, as they will this year. They're trying to extend this, though, into other communities. So please check out A Frontline Holiday on Facebook, and then also go to Here Be Monsters for shows tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday. And then one more. Two nights ago on Gather Round, I interviewed several people from the South Dakota reservations, Pine Ridge, and there is a major problem. So many elders and children have no heat. Some of them are heating with electricity. The electricity's been turned off. Propane is low for some people. Katani Bulger and Myrna Youngbear have been working with an organization called the Tetewan Grandmothers Relief Society for Winter Relief Fund. Actually, they're on Facebook. I botched that. It's Tetewan, T-E-T-U-W-A-N, Grandmothers Society for the Winter Relief Fund on Facebook. And all of these links I'm talking about will be on Aramar Tefio page after the show. So if there's any way that you can help with either of these causes, a frontline holiday is set up differently. The Grandmother's Relief will have, there's a list of people and numbers that you can call. You'll get the name of a family that's in dire need and the number of a propane company. So then you just give them your number, your information. And that way the family gets it. There's no money from us to anyone. It's all done with your charge to the utility company. So that was what I needed to say tonight. Definitely wanted to. These are causes close to my heart. So now we are just going right into Nick Brown. And also, you have a WordPress, you have a blog, Nick?
For a couple of blogs, antiimperialism.com with a hyphen between it, a lot of news analysis, theory, historical stuff, and then also revolutionary ecology. It's a new one that we recently started, kind of focusing more on the ecological issues that go into revolution, the ecological problems of capitalism, and why some of the environmental problems we're seeing today are very systemic and they're not going to go away by any means short of a revolution or short of overthrowing capitalism.
I totally agree. I know a lot of people don't want to hear that, and I just can't see any other way but throwing capitalism out the window somehow. Okay, because I had a wrong blog added for you. What again was the ecological one?
It's revolutionaryecology.wordpress.com.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't that, yeah, different. When did you start combining the third worldism, which we'll talk about in a minute, with the ecology movement?
You know, that's actually been a pretty recent phenomenon. Like myself personally, I kind of, as a teenager and everything, I was very involved in like green movements, you know, ecology club in high school and all of that stuff. So I was, as a youth, very interested in sort of green politics. At a certain point, I got more into sort of Marxism, and I kind of wanted to take some time to study that in depth. So I had a firm grasp on that before I went back to kind of discussing ecological things more. So it's been a fairly recent phenomenon, this a fairly recent development. The Revolutionary Ecology blog has only been up for, 2 weeks at the most. So it's pretty new. We encourage people to check it out. We're also seeking contributions of writings and other media from people. So if people have ideas or if they just want to shoot us an essay or something like that, we'd be glad to post it as long as it's, you know, good politics and everything.
Right. Well, I'm really glad to see you combining the two, because I think so many times politics or like the different parties totally forget ecology, and they go on with earth-threatening, species-threatening practices. And so it's so good to see, you know, that you're taking it further.
Certainly. And another sort of development is you have a lot of kind of greenwashing and kind of like imperialism using environmentalism and ecology as a sort of blunt weapon against the oppressed masses, and also a kind of ideological trick. You have kind of like this so-called green capitalism, which is recently developed, and, you know, a lot of people buy into that. So we're trying to present an alternative view whenever it comes to environmental issues as opposed to the kind of mainstream Democratic Party narrative.
Right. Well, and that's so sad, because you're right. They use it to try to control people and try to push them into a certain thought process. And it's like so many things that the governments do. It's just totally immoral the way they manipulate people. But I wanted to ask. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
Well, I was going to ask you. Now, you're the principal writer and organizer of this Third Worldism movement. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I guess, Third Worldism, it kind of precedes from Marxism, or it kind of jumps off from Marxism. It takes a lot of Marxist kind of understandings in regards to political economy, and kind of adds to that an understanding of global class dynamics, kind of the way different countries interact with each other, different capital centers interact with people in other countries. So what we suggest is that, there is a kind of global class divide. And what we kind of reject, I suppose, is this line that's workers versus the bosses. We don't think the world necessarily reflects that that paradigm in reality. So we kind of look at how, I guess specifically one of the things that makes us different is we're very critical of kind of chauvinism within the left and the way that imperialism uses profits gained overseas to kind of bribe its own workers into complicity. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot to kind of point that out and stress that fact. And we're very much against the idea that, socialism or progressivism just means more stuff for people, whether it's in the first world or whether it's kind of economist reformist demands in the third world. Certainly we want kind of relief for the third world, but, you know, it's not just about trying to make everybody a middle class. A lot of the left, that's kind of what their shtick is. They just want more people to be middle class. So we kind of reject that a little bit. Like I said, it builds off of Marxism. History is, you know, played out through class struggle. You know, the masses are the motive force in history. Also Leninism, talking about the state, how important that is in revolutionary struggles. I mean, in any society, the state is kind of like the instrument through which one class oppresses others. you know, upholding those sort of things, as long as well as Maoism, the kind of need to develop united fronts, the need after socialism to continue class struggle through cultural revolutions. So we kind of jump off from Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, and kind of stress the global dynamic of capitalism, how some societies are enriching themselves at the expense of others. I guess another thing that sets us apart from a lot of other Marxist groups is that we fundamentally and wholeheartedly support national liberation. So the kind of idea of politically breaking up the United States into different sovereign territories controlled by the oppressed masses within them. So the Black Nation, Native American nations, Chicano nations, Puerto Rico, Kanaka Maoli in Hawaii. So there's a lot of different oppressed groups within the United States that don't get a lot of representation with the left. And we try to present a different sort of narrative and a different sort of visual conception of socialism whereby these people are empowered, specifically at the expense of U.S. imperialism.
Yes, okay. Now, third worldism is under the umbrella of communism. Am I right or not?
I would say yes. I mean, it's definitely, at least you might have other kind of people out there vaguely referring to a third worldism. Ours is most definitely. It's basically Maoism, which understands global class dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, now, I recently was talking with an anarchist who said that it doesn't matter whether it's socialism or communism or what, as long as we have nation states, we aren't going to get where we want to go. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think nations are an objective fact of history. I mean, we can't wish these things away. And they're certainly not going to go away overnight. If anything, you know, through revolutionary struggle, you get the national awakening of people. You know, the Zapatista movement is a good example of a revolutionary struggle, which was concentrated amongst this oppressed nationality in the south of Mexico and kind of expressed their own autonomous, independent interest against foreign imperialism, against comprador capitalism in Mexico. You know, and it'd be great if the whole Mexican society rose up with the Zapatistas, but that hasn't happened.
Yeah.
Instead, you've seen kind of the resurgence of indigenous culture, you know, the particular aspects of national culture that are featured among these indigenous nations in the south of Mexico. So, you know, I certainly agree. I think that's kind of the end point of communism, is this kind of dissolution of national differences. But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. And I think socialism needs to liberate oppressed nations if it's going to be worthy of the name.
Okay. Yeah. There's so much fighting going on around the world that I think people in the United States don't understand, like in the Philippines.
Yeah.
There's a lot, and, you know, I mean, we've just, I don't know, I don't really watch mainstream media, except what I see on the internet because I threw my TVs out, but I don't think that there's much in mainstream media about that at all.
Oh, no, I mean, it's completely swept under the rug whenever it comes to the mainstream media. They don't want people to think about other people rising up against an unjust power structure, especially one that's partially aimed at them. You know, so you don't hear much about the Naxalites. You don't hear much about the People's War in the Philippines. You don't hear much about groups like MEND in the Niger Delta or the Zapatistas in the mainstream media. You know, they'd rather you think about Kim Kardashian and whatever she's doing.
Or,
you know, the recent, you know, kind of made-up controversy surrounding Obama or whatnot. I mean, the media is very much, it's an industry that's there to kind of bamboozle people, definitely. But also, you know, people kind of subject themselves to it as well. Nobody's forcing somebody to watch Fox News.
Yes, exactly. That is something I argue with people about, that, you know, we all do have some type of a brain, and we, in this country at least, I mean, we do have choices. And some people tell me, well, people have been dumbed down so much that they really don't feel they have a choice, and they're just comfortable doing what they're doing. But my question is, like, when when can we expect them to take responsibility for...
Yeah, it's kind of a condescending line, too. I mean, it just suggests that people are essentially, automatons or something like that, have no sort of agency or rationale into themselves, that they're just wholly the product of the media. It really does, it's a sort of cynical, pessimistic outlook that doesn't really offer a solution, but it certainly makes you feel better if you count yourself as somebody who isn't quote-unquote brainwashed, I guess.
Right.
Otherwise, it's really condescending, kind of, describes other people as basically idiots, which, that's how a lot of the so-called left really conceives the opposition, sort of underestimates them, just thinks they're foolish, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yeah, on the left, there seems like there's so many divides.
Certainly.
More than on the right, for sure. The right seems to have been able to band together over certain issues. They may have their smaller differences, but they will band together, whereas the left just, there's so much pettiness. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are fundamental differences in the left as well. I mean, I don't think it's all sort of petty issues, but mm-hmm. a lot of it is. I mean, our differences with much of the left are pretty clear-cut. We don't, support this kind of milquetoast middle-class version of socialism, which is, based on the privilege of a small minority of the global population.
Yeah. Yeah.
That sort of social imperialism, I guess, would be the technical term for it. Nonetheless, we're more than comfortable working with other, groups in the left who we disagree with. We're not these sort of like Puritan fanatics or anything like that. But I can't really speak to all the divides on the left simply because I don't, the divisions between one first worldist group and another first worldist group don't concern me too much, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you said, because you're one of the people who's very willing to work with anyone, pretty much, that is, I mean, even if you have the differences, but you're heading in the one direction. So it's like take care of the big issues, and then we can battle out the smaller things, kind of thing like that. So I know you wanted to talk also about the disparities between the first and the third world, and I mean, heaven knows they're there. You said something about the people a lot of socialists and all, and not just socialists, but people are in this country particularly, but others, they're looking for, maybe they think that the third world people all want everything that we have. So if you can bring more people up to middle class, you're really doing something. But that's just encouraging consumerism, which is killing the human race. So the disparities, I mean, there are some, but just because we have all these things doesn't mean that we're in any better condition, in my opinion. Morally, it's kind of, and better. So talk to us about the disparities, Nick.
Well, mainly in regards to material disparities. Marxism kind of postulates that a laborer works a certain portion of the day to replenish his own kind of labor power or her own labor power, basically to purchase the physical requirements of their own existence. And then the other part of the day is spent producing things that are called surplus, that's used by the capitalist as profits, things that are recapitalized into expanding the production process itself. So what this hinges on, exploitation hinges on, is that you're producing more, essentially, social product than you consume. And what I would argue is that a good portion of the first world actually produces much less than they consume. So there's that in terms of global disparities, and that's a pretty fundamental thing. It's just not, this guy gets paid $9.50, this guy gets paid, $10.50 or something like that. It's not like this kind of quantitative difference. It's very qualitative. And then there's the ecological disparity as well, the kind of shifting around of ecological ecological resources to the first world and sending back waste, pollution, you know, other sort of problems that are associated with it are always remains in the third world. So you have things like open pit cyanide mines for gold extraction, you know, and oftentimes it's a company like Newmont Mining that's based in Denver, Colorado, which is profiting from it, even though it's poisoning people around the world. Or, you know, things like cobalt mining for cell phones, computers, and things like that. Not a whole lot of places in the world have cobalt. Africa is one of them. A lot of times it's basically people in a hole with a pickaxe getting at this cobalt, sending it up, you know, pretty crude sort of production process. Nonetheless, it's fundamental to everything we, all of our global communication, everything we do today. And then what happens with these computers and everything once we're done with them, oftentimes we ship them to a place like China where they're quote-unquote recycled, but really just broken down. Computers include a lot of toxic waste, so it harms health in places in many cities in China, coastal China, where a lot of recycling is done. So there's a certain, not only a disparity in terms of labor allocation, but also environmental resources and problems. And it's a pretty fundamental thing. I mean, you're just talking about Pine Ridge. That's a pretty stark example, and that's definitely one of the poorest places in the United States that very much so does border on third world conditions. But nonetheless, there are plenty of places in the third world where the conditions are much worse than Pine Ridge. So, I mean, I think it is a fundamental matter, and I think it's oftentimes overlooked. You know, I went to a Walmart protest a couple weeks ago, right after Black Friday, just to kind of check it out. And, you know, a lot of it was this demand for a $15 minimum wage, yet they never mentioned where the products that Walmart sells come from. You know, they don't have the factory behind the Walmart where they're producing, like, the clothes, the plastic shit, and the plastic stuff and everything. So, you know, there's a sort of ignorance that's totally accepted, totally perpetuated within the left of this sort of international disparity. And we're hoping to really push a sort of politics that puts that in the forefront, that includes that with the rest of the program of the left.
Okay, the Walmart, the demonstration against Walmart and all, it's like, okay, that was great, but it wasn't the whole thing, like you mentioned, because I have people in Bangladesh, and, you know, they keep having those fires in those garment factories, and those are factories that make the clothes for Walmart and, you know, other big stores. And so many people don't understand the connection. I believe the United States has something like 5% of the world's population, maybe, and uses about 40% of the natural resources.
Wow, that's pretty outstanding. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not sure. I have no doubt. It's
pretty
much
horrible.
Of this consumer lifestyle that is, you know, promoted, accepted. And I guess going back to that whole Walmart example, I mean, I'm not, like, trying to attack the lowest members of American society the most materially deprived. But nonetheless, you know, if you get the $15 minimum wage, that was the whole reason people were getting involved in the struggle to begin with. If you get the minimum wage, you've kind of emptied out you've kind of pulled the rug out of from under yourself about how you're organizing, because you've essentially won. But if you don't get the $15 minimum wage, people just get discouraged. They give up. So it's not a very reliable platform for radical politics to begin with. And to ignore all the other problems with Walmart, you know, it's global supply chains, it's environmental destruction, and, you know, it's backwards philanthropy, everything like that. It's pretty problematic, to say the least, I guess.
Well, if it's just like a flash in the pan kind of thing, I don't know if that's the right expression, but like you said, it wasn't based on, like, real solid planning and organizing. There was nothing wrong with what there was, but it wasn't a deep. It was more horizontal.
Okay.
Then, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just made it to that one protest. I didn't watch a whole lot of news or media about it, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, it seemed like a lot of Democratic Party officials and union bureaucrats and things like that who were at the demonstration that I went to. And I'm not trying to say that living on $7 or $7.50 in the United States is easy or pleasant or anything like that. But that's not the typical American at the same time. That's not the typical white person especially, or the typical male especially.
Well, I live in a small town, and that pretty much is. As far as a lot of people are getting minimum, which I think it might be something like $7.75 or something, not very many people make $10 an hour in this area. And so it's, and you know, we did, I mean, mentioning Pine Ridge again, $2,400 a year. Can you imagine?
$2,400 a year.
A year.
Yeah, that's pretty low.
Yeah. So there are a lot of places where, and I mean, more power to the people. I guess it drew attention to, low wages, service people's wages, you know, fast foods and all this. But as far as making the companies do anything, I don't think it had any kind of effect.
Yeah, well, we'll see. And, you know, that's an interesting thing, too, because the United States is certainly less globally competitive than it used to be, and it's slowly losing its imperial edge, and it's kind of relying on militarism and very unproductive sort of sectors of the economy to buy you itself. And, you know, the United States emerged as the sole imperialist power really after World War II, basically after all the other imperialist powers were firebombed. So the U.S. emerged as this kind of the number one productive power in the world. Nobody could outproduce the United States. That basis of its global strength is no longer there, but it still has things like intellectual property rights, you know, a monopoly on global communication systems, you know, the dollar imperialism, you know, people trading in the U.S.'s currency, which it can manipulate at will, brute militarism. You know, if a country gets out of line or if Russia cozies up too much to a country, I mean, they can always just overthrow or try to at least overthrow the government. So the U.S. is somewhat becoming even more retrograde than it was in World War II, in the sense that it doesn't even have that productive capacity that it used to through which it dominated the world. It's just doing it through straight militarism and kind of political spectacle, cultural imperialism, things like that. So it's interesting to see the slide of the average American base, that they don't have these, you know, highly industrial or unionized industrial jobs anymore. You know, a lot of it's not as well-paying service industry jobs, which I'm not saying is great. You know, the service industry isn't fun to work in or anything like that.
No.
But it's not exactly like the economic engine of an imperialist power, so to speak. It's a means through which value is circulated and concentrated in the first world. And they're only going to be able to play this game for so long before another power kind of either gets pissed off and tries to, you know, mitigate the U.S.'s power, probably Russia or China, or before, you know, the U.S. just doesn't have the productive capacity in the U.S. or in the rest of the world quits playing the game.
Well, and yeah, I would see Russia or China doing something for the rest of the world for sure. I just don't think the rest, because so many countries are dependent. You know, there's something like 800 U.S. military bases in the world. And while they go in and murder the people and drone them to death, and the United States just killed 15 people in a wedding party in Yemen. It was a mistake. You know, that's what they say. They thought they had something to do with Al-Qaeda. These people were gathered, and it was a wedding party. So, you know, the United States, by their actions, of course, are not making friends, but they don't really seem to care, because they still, like, you. I mean, we spend, what, more than 50% of the money from the United States goes for the military machine? So, I mean, that's pretty high.
Well, and you got to think, I mean, if people out there listening are familiar with Marxism, military isn't a productive sector of society. I mean, so all the money that's spent on the military is essentially money that's come from the exploitation of actual productive workers, most of them being in the third world. So it's, you know, in a way, third world peoples are footing the bill to be trampled over by the U.S. military machine.
Yeah, yeah. And they're paying it some way or other, whether it's having their resources stolen by multinational corporations, that the U.S. and friends will go in and, you know, fight for the corporation against the native people. I mean, however it works, it's like wrong when you think about it. People actually clear their head and think about it without the prejudices or the biases or the lies we grew up with. I've just been really trying to study history because recently, in the last few years, I've found how much I was lied to in schools.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scary because everything was based on falsehoods. So now it's, you know, trying to sort it. I mean, there may have been, I don't know, maybe 30% was actual, really true, and then the rest. So I have a bitterness in that area because, and I know my professors, my teachers all, they were sincere. What they were teaching us, they believed because it went way before, you know, that.
Yeah.
But and even in our country, we know that we're taught differently. If we live in the South, the textbooks are different from the North.
Yeah.
I mean, like the history particularly, I have a friend who used to sell textbooks and explained how, it's different depending on where you live. So, you know, if we do that in our own country, can you imagine the lies we've told about other countries in our history books?
Mm-hmm.
So,
or even so, throughout today, I mean, it's interesting to see how the media and everything spins current events. You know, in Ukraine, there's kind of fascistic protests going on, yet, you know, much of the news outlets are labeling it as anti-government protests, things like that. But going back, you just said something about, you know, all these things being wrong. I guess as a kind of good Marxist, so to speak, I would suggest that, you know, morality is kind of a function of class relations. And another way to think about it is beyond it being wrong, eventually it's going to catch up with us. Even though at this moment, you know, we might have a pretty different, decent lifestyle compared to the rest of the world, eventually these problems are going to come back on us, whether it's environmental disasters or, you know, the rampant militarism that's taking over society. So, you know, for a lot of people, even in the first world, they do have a long-term interest in opposing imperialism and siding with the global proletariat. But it's not the very kind of clear, direct, oh, you know, I'm being overthrown, my country's being overthrown by the capital, you know, by this capitalist power, and, you know, I'm being forced to work in this sweatshop, and my ancestral land is being taken away. So it's a little bit more indirect and a little bit more long-term, but I think in some sense, most people around the world, regardless if they're exploited or not, do have a very clear long-term interest against the long-term or the consequences of capitalist imperialism.
Yes. So how do we help speed up that realization for them, for it to become clearer?
I mean, that's a good question. I think I wish I could say I had like this magic solution. I think in some respects you have to meet people where they're at. I think in places like the United States, we're faced with this interesting task where, you know, obviously a revolution here is kind of not in the works anytime soon, but there's still a lot of things that can be done to support the global process of revolution, you know, protesting and inhibiting reactionary policies by our government are a big thing, you know, pressuring the U.S. not to intervene in places like Syria or things like that can have a very direct sort of effect in the outcome of a conflict in another place. And I also think it's a matter of just building support now, you know, throwing these ideas out there and kind of generally more support and interest for communism, for socialism, for national liberation struggles, for people's wars in the third world. You know, and I don't think, you know, if we had 2% of the U.S. population on our side, that'd be, what, 6 million people? I mean, we're very far from that sort of point. But, you know, 2% of the U.S. population is a huge number, and I think that'd be something, if we had that sort of, those sort of numbers who are consistently down for revolution, and we're consistently working for it and kind of organizing for it, we'd be in a lot better shape. But we got to work just to get there.
Right. You know, a while back, they were talking about 10% of a population can totally change it, which in our country would be 30%. I mean, 30, million. But I recently saw, like you were saying, 2%. I saw the number, I think it was 2.5 to 3% of the population when they totally get on board with something, they can truly work wonders. And so I don't think that we're maybe that far from that. I don't know, Nick. What do you think?
I think there are a lot of people who kind of call themselves socialists and vaguely view themselves as a Marxist, but I think a lot of their politics are problematic simply because it is kind of a socialism for the first world, a socialism for middle-class people, and it's not really a sort of internationalist perspective of Marxism. I think whenever we get to that point, whenever people are kind of considering the global implications of their actions as it relates to revolution on the widespread long-term sense, then it will be something much more fundamental than, you know, 2% of the world's or the U.S. population kind of labeling themselves as a social, nominal socialist. Mm-hmm.
I did want to say that if people go to revolutionaryaim.wordpress.com, there mm-hmm. are several different things, I mean, articles, but what I wanted to mention is the fact that this is a place where people in certain areas of the country can get in touch with other people there. If you're anywhere, as I am, in the Chicago, Northwest Indiana area, Denver, Portland, Seattle.
They should definitely, even if they're not in one of those areas, they can always reach out to us. You know, maybe we've recently gotten in contact with somebody in a different area, and we're always looking for new contacts. You know, it's just good to have people on board, even if they're not part of a local cell. We definitely encourage local organizing in some fashion, whether it's in part of larger coalitions with liberals and anarchists and everything, or whether it's study groups or, you know, agitprop, whatever it is. It's always good to do local organizing. But even if you're kind of like a soul comrade, soul person out in the wilderness, give us a holler, see what we're up to, see if you can help us in any sort of way or if we can help you in any sort of way. And if you go to revolutionaryaim.wordpress.com, there's links to PDF magazines that have a lot of theory and news and analysis. I would definitely suggest reading those. There's also a recommended reading list at antiimperialism.com that has a list of books that are very good. You know, I always encourage people to study, too. It's very important to have an accurate conception of history that kind of aids revolutionary organizing today.
Right. And I mean, and just looking here, there's from Nepal to Native Americans to different, you know, Central African Republic, which we know now is just, I mean, that the place is blowing up. CAR. And so you have articles about a lot of places in the world. And that's good because that's another way to just really find out the truth, that which you're not going to get from mainstream media.
Certainly.
There's a man who I admire greatly in South Africa called Michael Tellinger, who is talking about probably mispronounced, is it like a contributism party called Ubuntu. He thinks that one of our major problems in the world is just the fact of money. And he thinks that if we didn't have money, We didn't do the barter thing necessarily, but if people just were allowed to do what they enjoy, that this could work. If I mean, and it might be like maybe 2 hours a week you might be signed up to do something you really didn't. I mean, but the most of the time you can do a job that you enjoy, you're creative with it, and we could do away with money. What do you say about that?
I mean, I think that's the ultimate aim of communism in some sense, is creating a society
yeah.
in which people are liberated from menial work, which, you know, everybody has to share in a certain amount of work, but productive efficiency is so high that, for the most part, people have plenty of leisure time and plenty of time to pursue the activities that they have passions for, whether it's art, music,
yeah.
you know, scientific discovery, playing with Legos, whatever it is, you know. So kind of unleashing that sort of creative spirit by liberating people from the drudgeries of you know, necessary labor.
Right.
But that can only come about once we have like a sort of democratic control over the means of production and
yep.
productive activities aren't serving the interest of profit.
Right.
And I understand the point he's making. I think it's not as simple as just doing away with money and everything will be perfect. I think that the doing away with money can only come about once we've solved a significant amount of issues beforehand.
Right. Yeah. It's I can't think of his name. I'm so embarrassed. I can't remember. In Florida, there's a man who talks a lot about automation socialism, and
mm-hmm.
because he says that, you know, if we were doing things to the degree that they could be, that maybe people might work 2 hours a day or every other day or something. Just work. But that's all it would take, because we weren't trying to store up that surplus like you mentioned earlier. And
I mean,
so everybody would be provided for, and there again, everybody could do something, whether it was scientific, music, play with their kids more, whatever. And that just sounds so ideal.
Yeah, and that's certainly always been like the Marx's conception of communism, but I think Marxism kind of points out this problem in that we can't get there by holding hands and kind of wishing ourselves there. In fact, it will take class struggle. I mean, if you read the Communist Manifesto, Marx even talks about this sort of politics. He calls it utopian socialism.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not going to come about just by our best intentions and hopes and everything, but, you know, conscious strategies that does involve organizing the masses for a revolutionary overthrow of capitalism.
Yeah. Do you see blood in the streets in the U.S. in the future?
I mean, I think any sort of system that has so much inequality is going to necessarily produce violence. Scientific studies actually back that up, that inequalities, you know, produce
mm-hmm.
violence. And revolution is an inherently violent act.
Yeah.
I think to some extent, some sort of violence is unavoidable. I'm certainly not one of these people that like fetishizes violence and thinks that we just need to, you know, wipe out all the parasites or something like that. I think it needs to be a kind of social transformation that can only come about through force. I mean, it's force which is preventing these sorts of things from happening. It's the armed strength of the bourgeoisie represented through militaries, police, things like this. So we definitely need a strategy which takes that into account and realizes that we're going to have to do something to overthrow these forces, to stop them from to prevent sort of armed counter-revolution, armed reaction, things like that. And it's interesting that the left has really dropped the ball in this area, and it's kind of been the right wing, and at least in the United States, where you do have people who are like, we're arming ourselves against the government.
Right. That's why I think
FBI
will be against us first. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a sense, the U.S. government is more afraid of kind of right-wing militia types than they are the immediate threat of communism in the United States. So it's interesting that the right has gotten that issue somewhat correct, the extreme far right. But the left has kind of dropped the ball and embraced this sort of passivism, which you know, is really a position of privilege in and of itself.
Well, what did you? How did you say that? Pacifism is a condition of what?
Pacifism is a position of privilege. I mean, it's
yes.
It's kind of ridiculous to tell oppressed people that they shouldn't fight against their oppressors, that they should defend themselves.
Yeah.
And most pacifists would candidly say that, you know, if somebody invaded their home and was trying to kill them and their family or do something bad to their family, that, yeah, they'd fight back. I mean, it's pretty natural that most people would, but somehow that's lost on them when it comes to politics.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, so many people mention Gandhi and Martin Luther King and different people who were, you know, well-known pacifists. However, you know, the people who supported them were not. I mean, there was a lot of bloodshed.
And even even Gandhi, I mean, he said – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, most liberals have this very one-sided view of Gandhi. Even Gandhi said that he'd rather people fight than do nothing. He'd rather people be violent than be a coward and not do anything at all, than just accept their oppression. And he said that nonviolence was a position that was very hard to take, that required a lot of discipline, et cetera, and that it was much more difficult than violence. But nonetheless, violence was better than doing nothing. And that's not what most pacifists will say today. You know, they would say that kind of violence is the problem, you know, that we can't resort to the problem to solve the problem, which, you know, wasn't Gandhi's politics in any sort of sense. He was a little bit more strategic than that. You know, and I think the system has a sort of interest in promoting figures like Martin Luther King and Gandhi, who were kind of conciliatory figures. You know, the only reason that the U.S. supported Martin Luther King was because there was a Malcolm X out there. The only reason Gandhi got support from the British was because the Communist Party of India was out there. You know, so these were kind of better solutions for the system than the more radical strains of politics out there. And in the present era, it's better for the system to kind of promote this milquetoast version of civil rights, version of anti-colonial struggles, than it is to present the truth about how it did take, you know, violence to even get these people any sort of recognition. Maybe not their own violence, but other people's violence.
Well, that's it. We just forget. And sure, the powers that be don't want us to think about that because they want us to be passive and nonviolent. So they don't want us to think on that or to dwell on the fact that it took a lot of violence to make the nonviolent movements work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's just plain strange.
Yeah,
but
people get a chance, they should check out the documentary Negroes with Guns. It's about Robert F. Williams, who was a prominent civil rights figure in the early 60s. He's kind of chased out of the United States, and he's essentially been erased from history because he had such radical politics. But during the time he was a very prominent figure, he got to public debates with Martin Luther King. You know, he was one of the main civil rights figures at the time, and because he had more radical politics, you don't hear anything about him. You know, most people don't know the name. Most teachers don't know the name. So,
right. I just want to say we've got 10 minutes left. I'm talking with Nick Brown from revolutionaryaim.wordpress.com and anti-imperialism.com. Also revolutionaryecology.wordpress.com. So you're just everywhere, Nick.
I try to be, I guess.
Yeah, well, you do an awful lot. Could you just tell us how the Marxism, Leninism, and Maoism all work together? Because it seems like most people say, oh, they're a Leninist or they're a Marxist or something, or Maoist, but you bunch them all together.
Well, yeah, I mean, I consider each one an advance upon the earlier. I think each one represents a sort of advance of experience by revolutionary movements. You had Marx, which kind of analyzed the capitalist system, who first kind of realized some of the inherent contradictions of capitalism. Leninism sort of represents the first successful revolutionary struggle, the lessons that were learned in that. And Maoism sort of represents not only the first successful revolutionary struggle, but the continuation of class struggle after socialism. So the Cultural Revolution, things like that, and also, you know, Maoism was very important in sort of applying Marxism, revolutionary Marxism, to the conditions of China and the rest of the Third World, semi-colonial, colonial countries. I don't think they're three different things by any stretch of the term. I think, like I said, I think each one builds upon the other based on new experience that was gathered throughout history. I don't really think Third Worldism is this fourth stage or anything like that. I tend to put it in parentheses or just use Third Worldism as a shorthand. A lot of these issues have been talked about for 100 years. You know, Lenin talked about the labor aristocracy and the difference between oppressor and oppressed nations. We're just kind of keeping that mantle of revolutionary Marxism alive, as opposed to kind of the more conciliatory, chauvinist versions of MLM that are out there.
Okay. No, that sounds, and you have called the Third Worldism movement the modern Third Worldism movement, so...
Yeah. I mean, there was definitely a trend in the 60s and 70s that accompanied the anti-colonial movement to kind of look towards the unity of the Third World. You know, there were figures like Lin Biao who spoke of a global people's war, you know, talking about the unity of the Third World. So it's not like we made all this stuff out ourselves or anything like this. So much of what we say isn't original per se. You know, we're not coming up with these breakthrough ideas that we're, you know, claiming are, you know, inherently significant based on our own thoughts. These are lines that have been around for a long time, for the most part. We've definitely done a little bit more investigation, a little bit more modern investigation, and added to them a little bit. But most of what we say is, you know, it's pretty standard Marxism, in my opinion, at least.
All right. But some of the plans then, and like you were talking about, just in the United States, I mean, like the Native Americans, maybe like running their own life, Puerto Ricans, the blacks in areas, the Hispanic. So, I mean, that's at least with those names, I mean, this is something new. This is something we don't hear about in this country.
No, certainly not for a significant amount of time. In the 60s and 70s, there was a lot more talk about national liberation, and there's still groups like the Unión del Barrio, who are very much about national liberation of the Chicano Nation. You know, around the Great Lakes region right now, there's a big movement to, I wouldn't say succeed, but emancipate Native American nations or indigenous nations in the area. You know, and there's also black nationalist groups that still exist, definitely not as popular as the Black Panthers were in their heyday,
right,
but nonetheless, they're still around. You just don't really hear too much about them from the mainstream left, I would say.
Yeah.
They get kind of ignored in the shuffle of, you know, liberal politics and pacifism and Democratic Party fundraisers, I suppose.
Yeah, there's just not enough time in mainstream media to cover real issues, maybe.
Even up in the mainstream left, the left does a lot to kind of alienate oppressed people as well by simply ignoring their objective conditions and their, you know, inherent demands.
Right. Well, I think there again, it's the left can be very condescending. You mentioned that earlier when I was talking about, you know, people talking about the American public being dumbed down. And it is condescending, but I think that so much, well, I shouldn't maybe say the left, but liberals can be very condescending because a lot of it, like you've already mentioned, is middle class. And while they say, oh, isn't that terrible, they don't understand the working people, the people who are working for minimum wage, and the minimum wage workers that are only getting 24 hours now a week with no benefits. They really don't get it. So there's a big disparity in our own country.
Certainly. And as it comes, you know, when it comes to issues involving oppressed nations as well, or There's a lot of kind of tokenism, it seems like, but not a lot of, like, substantive support for the actual issues or for the solutions which affect, you know, the most oppressed people in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, seeing that again, it's like, and just like the different countries that are fighting for their own independence or self-determination, people in this country don't have a clue. When I first started getting interested in Kashmir, it was, you know, my friends barely knew where it was. I mean, they thought it was some kind of a sweater kind of thing, you know? And because we aren't really taught. Yeah. And then the same with Palestine. People are, oh, well, you know, those terrorists, they're hurting poor little Israel. And, you know, they have such a skewed non-understanding of what's happening. But we've only got a couple minutes. Nick, what would you, words of wisdom for the night, what would you want to say to our listeners?
I guess, you know, focus on your strengths, develop and fix your weaknesses, and keep networking, keep organizing, keep studying. Definitely, you know, like I said, work on your strengths, if gain new skills. I was also going to, you know, plug a few projects, I guess, really quick. You know, antiimperialism.com with a hyphen, revolutionary news, analysis, theory. There's a group called the Maoist Internationalist Ministry of Prisons that does a lot of really great work organizing amongst prisoners in the United States. You already mentioned revolutionary ecology that discusses ecological issues. There's also a really great website that I've been working on called The Weekly Bolshevik, or it's just weeklybolshevik.wordpress.com. It's more like a calendar of events of different things happening in North America. So if you have an event that's going on in your area, please, you know, shoot me an email or comment on that blog. And also Systemic Capital, which features a lot of news and analysis of struggles in the Global South. So definitely check that out. People can always contact us. I guess other words of wisdom. I guess I got 99 problems and capitalism is all of them.
Okay. Yes. And you are on Facebook also.
I am. Yeah. Yeah. People can. I typically go by, you know, in my writing, I typically use Nikolai Brown, but on Facebook, I'm Nick Brown, N-I-C-K Brown, the propeller. Definitely hit me up.
Okay. Yeah, so, and we will have these links on Aramarte Fio, so also.
I'm going to run and send those to you really quick.
Right, yeah, get them sent to me, and I'll send them and put them around some different places, too. So, okay, well, Nick, I hope that you come back, because you really, really know what you're talking about, and a lot of us could sure stand to learn more, so... I want to thank you and just invite you back.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure, and I hope I can come back again.
Yes. All right.
All right.
And happy holidays. I don't know if you celebrate or not, but it's whatever. It's a family time, and so enjoy.
You as well. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Have a great night. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.